This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. The infamous pirate Blackbeard's flagship, the Queen Anne's Revenge, ran aground just 1 mile off Beaufort Inlet in 1718. Almost two centuries later, artifacts being recovered from the wreck are at the center of a legal battle. Lee Jenkins has more.
The Florida-based company Intercell Incorporated discovered the remains of the Queen Anne's Revenge in 1996. They want to sue the North Carolina Department of Cultural Resources over their legal right to exhibit and monetize the discovery. Despite repeated attempts to contact the State Department of Cultural Resources for an interview, they declined to comment. But I was able to speak with the chairman of Intersol, John Masters, about the company's legal battle. I understand that Intersol is a marine research and recovery corporation. Aside from discovering the Queen Anne's Revenge, what sort of projects have they undertaken in the past?
Intersol was founded by my father, Philip Masters. He was a self-taught researcher who visited libraries up and down the East Coast in Spain and in England. The first project that he worked on in the industry was on the Feversham Project, a British transport which sank off Nova Scotia. After that experience, he formed Intersol, and soon after, Intersol obtained permits from North Carolina to search for several ships at Beaufort Inlet, one of which was the Queen Anne's Revenge. And the other ship that we have a permit for in North Carolina is for the El Salvador, which is a merchant vessel that sank in the very same area at Beaufort Inlet in 1750 with considerable treasure on board.
Now, you're involved in a legal battle with the North Carolina Department of Cultural Resources. When did all of this start and why?
This all started with the 1998 QAR Memorandum of Agreement, which Intersol signed with the state soon after we discovered the Queen Anne's Revenge. So Intersol made the deal with the state in 1998, in which Intersol traded our rights to 3/4 of any treasure found on QAR. We traded that to the state of North Carolina in return for exclusive media and replica rights. Now, in 2013, DCR refused to renew the QAR MOA, and Intersol filed a complaint with the North Carolina Office of Administrative Hearings, and that led to the QAR settlement agreement in 2013. In which Intersol and DCR now agreed to share QAR media and replica rights. Intersol has filed its most recent complaint because DCR has refused to implement or adhere to the 2013 QAR settlement.
Just recently, Intersol made a motion to dismiss the case before the State Office of Administrative Hearings. What prompted this motion?
Intersol had hoped that with the demand letter we sent and with filing another petition with the Office of Administrative Hearings, we could resolve the matter without costly litigation. The North Carolina Attorney General's office has decided to raise arguments about the authority of the Office of Administrative Hearings to hear breach of contract issues, which OAH has heard many of those kind of cases before. It seems apparent that the AG's office and DCR were more interested in making new case law than resolving the issues with Intersol. So Intersol made a motion asking the court to dismiss the petition without prejudice, meaning there's no determination made, to do what we really hope to avoid to do, which is filing in federal court. And we will be filing in federal court shortly, and we will seek injunctive relief and damages and other remedies to the fullest extent that the law allows.
Had Intersol always hoped to have resolved this case with the Office of Administrative Hearings?
We hope that it could be resolved without costly litigation in state or federal court. Based on the arguments that from their statements and their motion, we decided it makes more sense to go ahead and file in federal court.
You mentioned arguments made by the Department of Cultural Resources regarding this case. What sort of arguments were those?
They did not respond to any of the points that we raised in our complaint. Like I said, they raised a pretty absurd argument about the authority of OAH to hear breach of contract issues. They also cited a rule that we must file within 60 days when it came to part of our complaint concerns the permit that we currently hold for El Salvador. They made grounds that our filing should be dismissed because it was more than 60 days. But our filing is based on breach of contract, not on the permit. So we don't believe that that applies.
What would be an ideal outcome for Intersol, and what chance do you think Intersol has in achieving that outcome?
The best outcome would be for the current settlement agreement to be implemented and followed, which is all that we're asking.
And what are the specifics of this current settlement agreement?
Well, the current settlement agreement states that Intersol and DCR will share media rights and replica rights.
What could all of this mean for Blackbeard museums and exhibits across eastern North Carolina?
That's a good question. As far as the current museum exhibit, DCR asked the legislature, and the legislature passed a law last year allowing DCR to charge admission at its museums. This has not been implemented yet, and we feel one of the reasons why is because charging admission at the museum would be a commercial opportunity that would be covered under the settlement agreement. Business atmosphere in North Carolina, we feel, would be damaged if a precedent is set that a North Carolina governmental agency can sign a contract with an out-of-state company and then not have to follow the contract.
John Masters, chairman of InterSAL. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
InterSAL plans to file their case in federal court within the next 2 weeks. For Public Radio East, I'm Lee Jenkins.
Coming up on the Down East Journal, we highlight a complex program aimed at understanding, predicting, and mitigating the impacts of hurricanes and tropical storms. But first, Greenville. It's one of eastern North Carolina's largest cities. Its changing landscape is the subject of an exhibit that opens this weekend. Sarah Finch has more.
Two distinct art forms have found common ground at Greenville's Emerge Gallery and Art Center. Local artists Sim Asher and Daniel Peoples create pieces that reimagine abandoned areas and revitalize objects through photography and wood design. Greenville is full of new buildings standing tall beside crumbling, neglected structures, areas prime for transformation. But before that happens, these two local artists have captured the raw beauty of the city as it stands today. Few would consider dilapidated buildings or a barn full of junk artistic, but photographer Sim Asher does.
People tend to see Greenville almost in a one-sided type of way. I think if you really dig deep and really start to appreciate its beauty, I chose the photograph and the panoramic because I feel like that can really engulf the viewer. With a panorama, you're getting a 180-degree view.
Asher considers his progressive twist on traditional photography a form of surrealism. He searches for odd angles, unique focal perspectives, and obscure objects that change the viewer's thoughts on a place or landmark, like an old beach bingo building on 10th Street.
I can remember myself driving past this building and how unique it looked because it looked like it was in such a desolate parking lot where nothing else was around it. And then literally a week later, the entire thing was demolished. I want people to realize that within the blink of an eye, something that was a former staple or a landmark is not so permanent anymore.
Whereas Asher preserves the old through photographs, wood artist Daniel Peoples restores it into unique furniture. With a background in woodworking and a thriving custom cabinet business in Pitt County, Peoples has the resources and the skills to transform discarded items into aesthetically pleasing and usable furnishings.
When people see the work, they realize that either that was going in a landfill or that was going to be thrown away or just that it wasn't going to be used. Maybe it was going to become firewood. Now it's got a new life and maybe even a more creative life.
Peoples incorporates unlikely objects and salvaged lumber into his sculptures to create a blend of old and new. From making a love seat out of industrial piping and a discarded bench, to building a cabinet with a rusty electrical panel and an oak branch, Peoples makes want from waste.
Found all kinds of goodies, and I've just been grabbing them and then creating them, and then as that happened, I started seeing other things around at my own studio, stuff that I'd set to the side. I was like, you know what, that would make a really nice table leg.
Despite the difference in medium and dimension, Asher's and Peoples' art relates conceptually. Their fascinating pieces invite the spectator to imagine the abandoned and discarded in a whole new light. You can view their artwork on display at the Emerge Gallery and Art Center. The exhibits open at 5 p.m. in conjunction with Greenville's Art Walk. The show will run through August 27th, and for more information, go to publicradioeast.org and click on the ENC events calendar. For Public Radio East, I'm Sarah Finch.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Warden Smith PA, a full-service law firm with specialized practice groups in real estate, agribusiness, elder law, and more. Warden Smith, dedicated to the practice of law. Information online at wardensmith.com.
As the end of our fiscal year approaches, we would like to thank you for your financial support throughout the year. Your gifts have helped make sure that the ideals and mission of Public Radio East thrive in Eastern North Carolina. Your additional gift now before June 30th, above and beyond your annual membership, will help Public Radio East maintain financial stability. It is only with your help that PRE remains the most important news and entertainment service available in the region. Please add PRE to your list of financial priorities by sending your tax-deductible gift by June 30th. Mail your donations to Public Radio East, 800 College Court, New Bern, North Carolina, 28562, or call 1-800-222-9832 to charge your donation on Visa or MasterCard. You can also make a secure online pledge at publicradioeast.org. Thank you.
Monday marked the start of the Atlantic hurricane season. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Climate Prediction Center is forecasting a below-normal season. There's a 70% likelihood of 6 to 11 named storms. 3 to 6 could become hurricanes, and 2 of those could become major hurricanes. Predicting the frequency and severity of coastal storms isn't an exact science, but a new North Carolina-based partnership is seeking to better understand, predict, and mitigate impacts from hurricanes and tropical storms. The Coastal Resilience Center of Excellence brings together university students and professors, the Department of Homeland Security and other federal agencies, private sector partners, and the first responder community to work collaboratively. Rick Lutick is the director of the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City and principal investigator for the Coastal Resilience Center of Excellence.
We have partners that span from Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Florida, Virginia, Rhode Island, New York. It's all sort of like the spokes of a wheel, if you will, and the hub is here in Chapel Hill and down here at the coast at the Institute.
In April, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security awarded a $20 million grant over 5 years to fund the center. While it's still in the very early stages, one of the goals of the program seeks to improve the predictability of hazardous conditions, such as flooding and storm surge. Lutick was among a team of researchers who spent 20 years developing a computer model for predicting how the ocean moves. And since 2000, they've been using the technology called ADCERC to determine the impact of storm surge.
Provides the ability to predict when a major storm comes, and that could be a hurricane or it could be just a nor'easter. It provides predictions of how the coastal ocean is going to respond. And, of course, what we really care about in many of those cases is how high the water is going to get and what areas might end up being flooded and how large the wave conditions might be because the waves provide so much damage.
ADCERC was used by the Army Corps of Engineers following Hurricane Katrina to design and improve the levee protection system around New Orleans. It was also used by the National Flood Insurance Program to reevaluate coastal hazard maps from New England to Texas. In North Carolina, ADCERC is run twice a day to forecast storm surge and flooding associated with upcoming weather events. Lutick says another area of the Coastal Resilience Center of Excellence will focus on how individuals and governmental organizations respond before and after natural hazards.
It's really trying to understand and help people make better decisions. There's a part that involves planning, city planning, if you will, or community planning. Try to understand what it takes to get people to build in smart places. So it's more than just response, which occurs afterwards. A lot of it has to do with understanding what goes into decision-making and the planning.
Lutick says the center makes the ADCERC storm surge model available to community leaders for planning purposes.
We actually run training programs for them, and we give them freely to the research community, to the various governmental agencies that work with them. And so we provide both training and the tools themselves out for those that are able to work with them to have access to them.
Another goal of the Coastal Resilience Center of Excellence is educating young scholars and professionals working on the ever-changing subject of coastal hazards.
The research that we're getting and the knowledge, some of the knowledge that we're developing is translating itself into undergraduate and graduate courses that are educating the students that come through the program and preparing them for various levels of careers in the field.
The new Coastal Resilience Center of Excellence received an initial $3 million grant for its first operating year. A planning meeting is set at the end of July in Washington, D.C., with the hope to involve officials at multiple levels of government at that time. The center will be fully operational in early 2016, where they will begin to work with officials in North Carolina and other states. According to the Department of Homeland Security, the move expands on existing efforts by the Coastal Hazards Center of Excellence, which was formed in 2008. The Coastal Hazards COE informed the U.S. Coast Guard on operation decisions related to staging ahead of Hurricane Sandy. I'm Jared Brumbaugh.
This is Lisa Rayburn, Horticulture Agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. My garden is really starting to gear up for summer. I started harvesting cucumbers this week, one on Saturday, one on Monday, 10 on Tuesday, and now I'm just trying to stay out ahead of them. The potatoes are almost ready to harvest, and the tomatoes will be ripening soon. This is one of my favorite times of year, with lots of things going on in the garden. In every year, I learn new things and promise myself that I'll remember them for the next season. However, the reality is that things that do not get written down are often forgotten, and this is true in my garden, and probably in yours too. So if you don't already keep a garden journal, or you haven't kept your journal up to date, dust it off and get started. A garden journal is an extremely useful tool that can be used to record planting dates, the varieties that you grow, how varieties performed, when crops were harvested, and more. You can adapt the idea of a garden journal to either your vegetable garden, your flower bed, or use the same notebook for both. One of the biggest benefits of the garden journal is keeping track of the varieties that were planted. Each year, I like to plant different varieties, and sometimes I can't remember how one stacked up against another, based on taste and texture. This year, I planted a variety of cucumber called Sweeter Yet. The long, slender, almost spineless fruit of Sweeter Yet have a crisper texture and sweeter taste when compared to my normal variety, Bush Crop. Likewise, I planted early Alaska Snow Peas as well as Sugar Snap. While both vines grew and yielded well, the early Alaska pods were more fibrous and therefore less fun to eat. I'll certainly take this information into consideration when I choose my varieties next year. You can either jot the varieties down in your notebook, or you can even tape the seed packets or variety tags right on the page, or use a plastic page protector to corral them. A journal is also a useful tool for tracking pests. If there's a pest emergence pattern, such as the last 2 weeks in June or after a heavy rain, you know what to look for and when to look for it as you monitor your garden. You may also find cultivar differences not listed in the catalog. For instance, I've noticed that my Bush Crop cucumbers already have powdery mildew, while the Sweeter Yet variety still has nice clean foliage, another plus. Likewise, one of my colleagues noticed that she planted 3 green bean varieties 1 year. Mexican bean beetles fed on 2 varieties, but left the 3rd alone. Her garden journal told her which ones to plant and which ones to avoid the following season. If you are feeling very ambitious, you can record the weight of the produce you harvest as well. This is a great way to determine the value of your garden to your household budget, and to compare differences in productivity between varieties. Several years of data in my garden indicates that while I prefer the taste of Yukon Gold potatoes, the yield is typically lower per plant than it is for the hardy Pontiac Red. Luckily, I have the luxury of gardening for fun, and yield is not the only factor I need to consider. When you're making notes in your journal, you'll also want to record weather patterns, as they can influence the insects, diseases, and yield in a season as well. Include where you planted individual crops to help make garden rotation easier. Also include when and how you pruned, fertilized, staked, or trellised. I'm already making a note to make sure that the trellises for my Sweeter Yet cucumbers are taller next year. Your notes from this summer will help you make better informed decisions in the garden season after season. But your garden journal is only useful if you keep it up to date. So run outside now and take some notes.
It's live music at the beach. The Friends of Fort Macon concert series is happening again this year. The next performance takes place on Friday, June 12th, with the Cajun Zydeco Band from Gloucester, The Unknown Tongues. This week, Mac McKee speaks with Tom Kelly, the president of the Friends of Fort Macon, about the free concert series.
Tom, thanks for being our guest today on the Downeast Journal. Now, you already have one summer concert under your belt this season as the Carteret Sunshine Band performed over the Memorial Day weekend. How successful was that concert?
Turned out very, very well. We had absolute picture-perfect weather, nice and cool out. The band had a new selection of tunes for us. We had about 475 people there, which is not as much as we get during the peak of the season, but for something in the last week of May, that was quite good. So we were very pleased with it. We just hope the weather holds up like this the rest of the year.
Your next concert is June the 12th, and it's the band that's been around for a while called Unknown Tongues, and I hear they play Zydeco. Can you kind of give us an example of what that is, a definition?
Zydeco is, some people call it Cajun music. Just think in terms of New Orleans kind of music. The Unknown Tongues are really authentic portrayers of that kind of music, and they're very popular in the local area.
On June 26th, it's Saracen Kettner, and they've been around the Crystal Coast music scene for about 30 years.
They have. They've been around for a long time. They actually they make a living playing this music. They write a lot of original music. They have a number of CDs out, and they play everywhere from Cape Cod down to Key West. And so we're lucky to grab them for our June 26th show.
July 10th, the only thing I know about this particular band coming up, Wild Honey, is it's also the name of a Beach Boys album from 68. Can you tell me what they're about?
Wild Honey is a duo. This will be not the first time they're playing at the Fort either. They're a local guy and a girl, Angie Cooper, who's pretty well known in this local area, both as a performer and a concert organizer in her own right. They play everything from country to contemporary pop, folk, and again, they're another group that has a following, and we love to have them there.
Jumping ahead to July 31st, you have a group called Forever All, and August 7th, Samantha Casey and the Bluegrass Jam. That's rather self-explanatory there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on July 17th, you have a kind of a unique band that's kind of different from all the other musical styles you've described called the Moorhead Brass.
We try to mix up the music as much as we can, but the Moorhead Brass, they're very unique in that they're a group of five brass players from tuba to horns, and they play music that's from show tunes to pop music to classical. They have everything arranged specifically for a brass ensemble, and they're very, very popular at the Fort.
Do these concerts help fund events that take place at Fort Macon State Park and maintenance on the Fort as well?
Well, we're proud to say that we've been doing these for 18 years now, and they've always been free. But we do ask for donations, and we have a donation box at the concert. So anything we get in donations, we are able to turn back into projects, and we have more projects than we'll ever have money for that we can get involved in at Fort Macon. Our main purpose in putting these concerts on is to bring people to the fort, locals and tourists, let them see what's there, and then they'll come back and take a tour with us and really learn about the history of Fort Macon, which is a fascinating place, and get to see that beautiful spot on the end of Bogue Banks.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you very much.
The next performance, part of the Friends of Fort Macon concert series, is The Unknown Tongues, Friday, June 12th at 7 p.m. And for more information on the free summer series, go to publicradioeast.org and click on the ENC Events button.
Come in, Dave. Tell you a lie. Of hearts have been broken.
just cause these words were spoken. I love you, yes it's true, I really love all y'all. But if you break my heart, I'll die. So be sure that it's true when you say I love you. Sin to tell a lie.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, you can drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. And again, we want to say thank you to everyone who made a pledge during our end of fiscal year fund drive. As we close out the end of our fiscal year, listener support is more important than ever. We have a goal to raise $60,000 before June 30th. You can help keep Public Radio East fiscally sound with your support. Pledge online at publicradioeast.org. And thanks.